Welcome again to another edition of the IDS Hour. I'm Paul Honeycutt, elder at New Covenant Bible Fellowship, joined by Jeff Volker, also an elder at New Covenant Bible Fellowship and a director of in-depth studies here in Tempe, Arizona. Today, as promised last week, we are going to start probably an eight-week or so study or look at a book entitled The Reformers and Their Stepchildren. The book is authored by a fellow named Leonard Verdine, who actually lived here in the Phoenix area for a number of years. I've never had contact with him, but I know he was a local, at least for a time. And this is a fascinating book. I had not read this before. Jeff had, with in-depth studies, had gone through this book many years ago, and for whatever reason at the time, I wasn't able to do it. And I've just been fascinated so far I've read the introduction in the first chapter. And what I'm going to have Jeff do, because he's way smarter than I am, is I'm going to have him kind of give us a introductory overview, and then we're going to tackle this first chapter.
Yes, I came across the book, 20-some, 30 years ago. And in my own trek theologically, of course, I came into the doctrines of grace when I was in seminary, and then somewhere around 1978, I graduated from seminary in 75, and then 78, I began to first come across the very basic structure of New Covenant theology. And it was there that I began to think about these things, that my understanding of salvation comes from the Reformers, clearly so. Justification by faith alone and how it all works. But my concept of the church doesn't come from them. It comes from the Anabaptists. And that's what Verdine is doing in the book. Verdine, by the way, just to tell you something about the author, I believe he's dead now. He used to be retired out here in Phoenix. He was part of, I believe, a Christian Reformed church up in Michigan, a Reformed church. So he's at a church that would hold to the Belgic Confession or the Heidelberg Catechism, the Canons of Dort, and yet he sees this issue very clearly. He just seemed to have an ability to just really dissect this issue with tremendous clarity. Now, he has another book, while we're just introducing this, which is more of a background book to this, because it's more of a theoretical book. It's called The Anatomy of a Hybrid. You can still get it. Probably it's easier to get it used. But it talks about just the most, it breaks down the issue of church and state and the separation. Here in The Reformers and Their Stepchildren, what he does is he takes eight chapters, and that's why we'll take 8 weeks to go through this. And he deals with, each chapter is entitled with a negative term that the Reformers, the Lutherans, whatever, they called them this. This was a negative term that they were described with. And he takes each of those terms as describing one aspect of what they believed. And it's very accurate, and I think it's a great way to do it. And he talks about the biblical truths that the Anabaptists held to with regard to the relationship of the church and state and what is the church. But he does it, sorting through the history, mm-hmm. particularly the time of the Reformation. And we find it fascinating. We find it in a book that's easy to read, and in the sense that it's engaging. It's hard to read really fast because he says so many things that cause you to stop and ponder. Because in that sense, at least from my point of view, it's a very rich book because it causes you to think about so many things. So we would recommend the book right off the bat, as a wonderful resource. You're going to have to decide it for yourselves as you work through this stuff, because obviously you ought not to buy into our point of view without checking it out yourself. But at least we're putting our cards on the table and telling you, where we're coming from. Because we do have a particular prejudice that we're approaching this. We think it's based on fact, but nonetheless, it is our point of view.
Well, just to start that out, then, the very first sentence of the first chapter, he says, one of the terms of reproach used by the Reformers as an incriminating label of the second front, which is also a term that's used, was and I'm going to get this wrong probably, Donatist.
Donatist, yes. Okay,
now, who were the Donatists?
Ah, okay, even before we did that, we should just put some terms out there, make sure we don't confuse these. At the Reformation, of course, you had the Roman Catholic Church, then you had the Reformers, of which you divide them up between the Lutherans and the Calvinists. Okay, that's a simplistic, but I think it's fairly accurate. But both the Lutherans and the Calvinists both had the concept of the church and state getting wedded together. So then you had this other group of evangelicals who would have, you know, appreciated in general the Reformers' view of salvation, but not appreciated their, not agreed with their concept of the makeup of the church and its relationship to the state. These would be the Anabaptists. And the Anabaptists are also called, and Verdine does it in this book, calls them the stepchildren of the Reformation. Stepchildren. And then there's another term which he introduces. He calls the Anabaptists the second front.
Right.
So when you hear this stuff as you go through the book, be aware that's what he means. Just another way of describing the Anabaptist point of view. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, go on. No.
Donatists. This, you hearken back, this is a historical controversy in the 4th century, which would be the 300s. The Donatists were, first off, this is talking about the response, what took place after the persecution, intense persecution of the Roman Empire ended. So during this period of persecution, you had church leaders fold under the pressure, and they would, one of the things, they would turn in other believers. They would also give up scripture to have it burned. And so now, here now, persecution goes, particularly they're referring to North Africa, which is where this is historically, controversy is located. And you had this difference of opinion. You had folks, professed believers, who said, these guys, these leaders who, you know, who turned their back on being faithful, these leaders now are saying, we repent. And we should be let back in. The Roman Catholic Church, the church that became Roman Catholicism, says yes. But then there was a group who questioned, I think, the sincerity of these guys and said, no. These were the Donatists. And they would say that, no, the church, they are pursuing a purity of the church. And this, they even took it a step further, so that if one of these guys who, you know, was not faithful, if he now, quote, repented and the Catholic Church accepts him back, if he baptizes somebody, the Donatists would say that baptism is not valid because he was not valid. So that is, in a simplistic way, that is the historical controversy. So it's really not strictly, we want to be honest about that, it's not strictly a battle between the separation of church and state. It's really not. But it is true that the Donatists were seeking a purity of the church that the church, Catholic Church as a whole, wasn't buying. And so in seed form, this issue was there. So now what Verdine does, he takes that and he says, here's the problem that you find at the Reformation. You got the Reformers who recovered the biblical gospel, which is wonderful, but they didn't go far enough. They embraced still the Roman Catholic grasp of the church and the state get wedded together. And so here you have the Anabaptists who are now saying, no, guys, you haven't gone far enough. You need to, the church is a voluntary society that, you know, and it's not, cannot be equated in any respect with civil authorities or just the population in general. It can't be equated with that. It's separate. And there's distinct roles for the civil leaders versus church leaders, and even the Bible, which we will get into this, clearly differentiates the two different spheres.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the general historical background out of which Verdine is working. But forgetting those details, it is clearly true that the Anabaptists were called Donatists.
Or Neo-Donatists.
Or Neo-Donatists, yeah, the new Donatists. They were called that.
Yeah.
That was a term because the Reformers felt that they were pushing for an unrealistic understanding of the church. Unrealistic.
What I found fascinating, and this playing along with that, and this is interesting, he says this, for all pre-Christian society was sacral. Sacral community, sacral society. He says, by the word sacral, which we shall be using frequently and which we request the reader to impress on his mind, we mean bound together by a common religious loyalty. He says, by sacral society, we mean society held together by a religion to which all the members of that society are committed. Now, what's fascinating to me as I was reading this, it really, like, lights were going on. When you think back, I mean, look at Caesar, Roman Caesar. You know, that was all, you know, you had to worship Caesar. And all, you know, and even pre-cultures before that, there's always a religious aspect to the society overall. And it seems to be kind of a one religion fits all within that society. But then you come to Constantine.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in essence, does the same thing, doesn't he? You go from an era of persecution in Rome and in the early church to when Constantine supposedly becomes a believer, suddenly embraces Christianity and makes it the new state religion. It becomes a sacral society. And that's kind of the beginning of all this, isn't it, for, as far
yeah.
as the church is concerned?
It really is, because sacral society just means that the church is equated with the civil society. That is, everybody in that country has the same religious views. And the idea is that, and this goes back way back, is that religion is the glue that keeps society together.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, everybody has to be on the same page. Otherwise, you'll have civil unrest. And so that idea has been with us all along. People forget that the first large-scale modern experiment in the separation of church and state was the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so Europe, all the European countries, no, that was just assumed that, you know, this country, is it a Lutheran country? Is it a Catholic country? Is it a Reformed country? And then you had England, the Church of England.
Right.
Okay, it just, they were, everybody just assumed that. There were pockets of things that weren't that, mm-hmm. but not as a whole. So that's a huge deal. So you get Constantine, and let's sort of focus on him for a moment. In the 300s, he, and forget the story about him becoming, quote, a believer. I'm skeptical, but it really doesn't matter. The bottom line is, he's the emperor of Rome. He changes his mind. First, he makes Christianity an acceptable religion in the empire, so there's no more persecution. But then he moved, shortly thereafter, that Christianity is the religion of the Roman Empire. And so at that point, they started punishing everybody else who wasn't outwardly Christian. So you have this same persecution going on that was that believers felt the brunt of under the Roman Emperor before Constantine. Now the non-Christians are experiencing physical persecution by, quote, the Christian Roman Empire. And so we see it's the same problem. Now, if you move it a step, just sort of bring it into most of our audience, though not all is, from the United States. We're aware that a lot of people hear this from overseas, particularly if you're from Britain, then you are our friends across the pond, then you would understand, you know, when the United States gets founded, you know, in its formative years, we understand there's the Massachusetts Bay Colony, mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, and they came to the United States, these pilgrims, these Puritans, because of they wanted religious freedom. But we need to understand, they wanted religious freedom to do it their way. They still had the church and state wedded together. Mm-hmm. They just didn't like the version of it in England. So here in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, you couldn't vote unless you were a free man. You couldn't be a free man unless you were a church member in good standing. Couldn't be a church member in good standing unless you were Sabbatarian, infant baptism, all sorts of doctrinal issues. Well, whoa, if you're a Baptist, you got a real problem of being just a citizen in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which is where why we ended up. Roger Williams, Rhode Island, which became one of the first states to allow true religious freedom, tolerance and didn't establish any one religious preference as the religion of the land. So this is what Verdun is introducing in this very first chapter on Donatism, the Neo-Donatists. He's just sort of pointing out that this is the basic issue, that you cannot think of the church in terms of it's just the people in a geographical area. It has to be a voluntary, he'll make this point, a voluntary society, people who opt to be part of this group because they share these common beliefs. But it has nothing to do with what the state holds religiously. It's irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he makes a couple points where he says that Donatism was essentially a protest against the new sacralism, which would be the Constantinian thing and the
yes.
Roman, whatever. Which, by the way, we'll talk about Augustine in a minute, just how he plays into this. But then he goes on to say, Donatism as a movement in the 4th century was successfully suppressed, but the ideas of Donatism lived on. Because remember, he talks about, at one point, as I remember, this kind of undercurrent or almost underworld of influence that permeates all the way back. So that's why he starts back there.
And he's absolutely right. Yeah. You see this sort of bubbling up in church history, these ideas, this... Mm-hmm. We would say people coming to their biblical senses of saying that the church and state have to be separated. What is the church? It is a family of believers. It is not just people who live in a geographic location. And we see it bubbling up, but usually when it bubbles up, the authorities are so powerful they can just squelch it.
Exactly.
But at the time of the Reformation, the Roman... You know, the Holy Roman Empire was not of sufficient power, mm-hmm. at least in Germany and part of Switzerland, that they could do that. And so now you had emerged these ideas that always raised up their heads at varying points in church mm-hmm. history. Now they have a chance to actually get established.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we see Anabaptism getting established, even though it's quite difficult, but we see it established. And it was because in the Lord's plan, the political scene was conducive for it, where before it was not.
Right. Before we come up to the age of the Reformation, just one other last point on the 4th century. Augustine, I've read some years ago some biographies about him and so forth. I know this whole Donatism issue was a big deal to him. He battled it, as I remember, or what have you. What do you know about that?
Well, Augustine is an interesting person because both Roman Catholics and Protestants claim him
mm-hmm.
as sort of a patron saint. And Catholics like him because he, let's say, on baptism, he believed in predestination, which is what the Protestants like, but he also believed that you had to be baptized to be saved. So if an infant was going to be saved, you had to be baptized. And so he holds to some views that are distinctly Roman Catholic that we would just not buy at all. But on the other hand, he's very pro-predestination, which is what we like. And therefore we claim that aspect of him. But in all honesty, you got both sides
mm-hmm.
in there. And he did clearly side with the Pope on the issue of Donatism, that this sort of... He didn't take the side of what we would call the purity of the church. He didn't do that.
Right.
And we would view that as a weakness in Augustine without minimizing the positive things that he said.
So if we come forward then to the Reformation.
Yes.
We just finished on one of our in-depth studies, intense theology sessions that we did for almost 2 years. We just finished going through Calvin's Institutes. And I think of Calvin in Geneva and the whole church-state mm-hmm. model there. And there's something in here about Luther. It says, Luther stopped short of full reformation, content to walk hand-in-hand with the state, bogged down halfway between Catholicism and the New Testament church organization. So both guys, in their time and their situations, embraced some form of a sacral society.
Yes. Now, each is a little different. Luther, of course, is at the very beginning of the Reformation because he's a catalyst for that.
Mm-hmm.
But he seems at the very beginning, his works, that he was really more gravitating toward a church as a voluntary society. But it seems rather quickly he saw that without the arm of the state, the sword of the state, the power of the state, that his reformation was going to be squelched. Mm-hmm. And so then he saw, then he shifted, or he embraced the role of the state, which was his Frederick Elector of Saxony, who was his patron, who was supportive, but he had control of everything, that he entered into sort of a hand-to-glove relationship with him, church wedded to state, to accomplish good goals, which is to get the gospel out there, but in reality, it just mucked things up. Mm-hmm. Unlike Calvin, who when Calvin shows up on the scene from France into Geneva, the Reformation's already, Calvin is later than Luther, the Reformation is already going full tilt. So now Calvin now, once again, has to sort of adapt himself to the current setting in Geneva, and we seem to see in Calvin a desire to have, in one hand, the church separate from the state, but on the other hand, just this distinct willingness to live with it. So, example, on church discipline. Mm-hmm. There was the church leadership, and then there was the city council in Geneva. The church leadership did not have the power to excommunicate somebody. Only the city council had that. And then, if we were kind of focusing in on Calvin, then we have this rather unique historical account of Servetus, the heretic. And from all accounts, Servetus was a heretic. He denied the Trinity. And depending on who you read, he was sort of a bit of a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that if you have this understanding of a sacral society, that religion is the glue that holds the fabric of society together, then heresy becomes equated with civil unrest. Ah, potential something to divide a nation. Mm-hmm. And so we see that Servetus was ultimately, even he's tried at the church, but it's the power of the state that executes him, that this is how you deal with heresy. Now, it is true, because Verdine will talk about this in his first chapter, Calvin is seeking to get to reduce the punishment from burning at the stake to hanging. But Verdine makes the point, which I think is probably more accurate, mm-hmm. that it's not that Calvin, just with a pang of conscience, wants Servetus sort of to get a lesser sentence, but that you want, the reason he's actually being killed is not religious reasons, but civil reasons. Hanging is capital punishment for a civil offense. Burning the stake is capital punishment for a religious violation. Mm-hmm. And so it would make it look better. But in reality, Servetus is being burned to stake because he's a heretic. He was a heretic, but this is not how we handle error within the church. We handle it with church discipline, which we'll get into in greater detail down the road. Mm-hmm. But that's part of the problem. So right. It's fascinating to look at it through the eyes of what happened in Geneva with Calvin, Servetus, etc.
Right. In fact, he mentions this in talking about that Servetus episode. He says, the burning of Servetus, let it be said with utmost clarity, was a deed for which Calvin must be held largely responsible. He says, the event was a direct result of the sacralism to which Calvin remained committed, a sacralism which he never discarded.
True.
Definitely puts.
But
along these lines, because that raises this whole point, and I love this. This was fascinating. He's talking about he's quoting Peter as recorded in Luke 22:38, and it's where Jesus is at the Last Supper, and Jesus says to him, he says, "But now, if you have," we're talking about. He says, 35. Jesus asked them, "When I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" "Nothing," they answered. He said to them, "But now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment." The disciple said, "See, Lord, here are two swords." That is enough, he replied. Now, Verdine says this. He says, out of the words of Peter, recorded in Luke, Lord, here are two swords. The church distilled the ridiculous doctrine that Jesus intended his church to have two swords, the sword of the spirit, which the clergy wields, and the sword of the steel, which the soldier swings. So it's that idea that they're working in tandem somehow, which, again, talking about Servetus, is a perfect example.
Yes. And before we finish up on our study, let's just kind of go into Scripture a little bit more. In Romans 13, which is the locus classicus, the main place, it talks about the role of civil government for those of us who are believers who live this side of Pentecost in the New Covenant era. Let me just read a little bit. Romans 13, beginning at verse 1. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Now, what he's saying is that every government that exists has been established of God. There is no distinction between good and bad governments that we would normally make. Every government is. And so the governments are not... There is no requirement in the teaching passages of the New Covenant era, the law of Christ, there's no requirement that governments have to be of believers because the church is separate from government. Mm-hmm. The government is simply a vehicle that keeps order. And they do it to a better or, you know, good or bad degree, but they do that. And so we describe this way, because Verdine uses this terminology. He will say that, okay, the government is the civil government is the role of common grace. That is, because we're made in the image of God, everybody, that everyone has a sense of right and wrong, and so government cares for its citizens, protects them, and that there is no requirement to be in government to be a believer. Whereas the church, the local church, is a sphere of special or saving grace, that is, it's only made up of those who profess to be believers, mm-hmm. and therefore, they are ruled by the biblical directives, commands, whatever, that tell us how we're to function as believers in the church. So you have two different spheres. Mm-hmm. And Verdine's argument, which we wholeheartedly agree with, is you cannot mix them. And of course, when the church, like Geneva with Calvin, seeks to use, they want to excommunicate Servetus, which is fine. That's very biblical, Matthew 18. But then they want the civil authority to execute him. No, that's not their role.
I imagine the Jews with Pilate, don't they?
Yes. So we just have scratched the surface. We'll get into much more detail as we progress through. I think this is an excellent book to go through.
I agree. We're just scratching the surface. If any of this is tweaking you, by all means, buy a copy. You can get them for as little as $3.50, I think, used on Amazon. Couple just kind of closing things here real quick. One of the things that I found interesting in talking about this whole idea of a civil authority, etc., one of the accusations they made against the Anabaptists was that they tried to say that they were anti-civil magistrates, which was completely false. That wasn't the point. But what's interesting, as I was reading this, it dawned on me, as an American, grown up in America and all that, I don't understand the idea of a sacral society as such. I mean, the moral majority tried to create one, that didn't work. But the idea of the First Amendment, and he quotes it, he says, the First Amendment says, amendment to our Constitution, says, Congress shall make no law establishing religion, nor prohibit the free exercise thereof. He says that was the death sentence of Christian sacralism. And it really was. Yeah. Right now, under our Constitution, it's not possible.
So we just really, as we've kicked off this first of eight sessions on the IDS Hour on the Reformers and Their Stepchildren by Leonard Verdine. We encourage you to follow along with us, that you know, to get the book and use it, and it's very profitable.
And if you have any questions, as always, give us a call
at 480-924-4290, and we'd be glad to interact. You can email, and then we can call you back, interact. I just don't indulge in any long emails, and because I think that's a very unsatisfying means of communication. Yeah. But anyways, we're glad to interact with you.
Great. See you next week.